Well, I don't think it ever gets any better than this, an occasion to celebrate Norman Podhoretz and Midge Dechter, and to do so under these auspices. We are in the building that once housed Commentary and that is now the home of Tikva, and we are in the presence of New York's most distinguished intellectual couple, by a long shot, among some of their family, colleagues, friends, and admirers. And so this evening is part of a series of talks devoted to the New York intellectuals. But our hosts, Roger Hertog and Eric Cohn, saw this as an opportunity for Thanksgiving, a chance to acknowledge how much this pair has given us and how much we've learned from their ideas and example. The little that I can say will only hint at their immeasurable influence, and I will begin with gratitude. So intellectuals tend to be critics. And indeed, Norman recalls that when he was starting out professionally, what he wanted to be was a critic, a calling that was greatly honored at the time among the New York intellectuals, and one that many of them identified as the essence of their work. Now, the professional critic may occasionally offer a favorable assessment of the subject under review, but it's not for nothing that the term criticism has a negative association. The honest critic upholds the standards of excellence that inspire a society to live up to its potential, and he often does so, and she often does so, by showing why the things under review don't meet the higher criteria. So Norman was a masterful critic and demonstrated how important criticism could be. His review articles collected in his first book, Doings and Undoings, are still a model for anyone who takes literary criticism seriously and wants to practice it honorably. Yet, the last of his several intellectual memoirs concludes with a section called Dayenu, American Style, where after going through the many parallels to the Dayenus of the Passover Haggadah, he writes, "In the end, I suppose, it all comes down to gratitude. Gratitude was once regarded as a great virtue. It is, for example, at the very center of Judaism, which requires an observant Jew to thank God so often that it is a wonder he has time for anything else." So, the title of that memoir is My Love Affair with America, Acknowledging and Promoting the Habit of Appreciation as an Expression of That Love. The book is written to restore gratitude as a civic virtue. Now, much the same thing holds true for Midge Dechter's wise and clever memoir, An Old Wife's Tale, 2001, that focuses on what is going wrong in America. One of the blurbs for the book describes the author as, quote, a merciless critic of the danger and self-deceptions of American culture and politics since the 1960s, and so she has been to her great credit. And yet, this book likewise ends in grandmotherly strains of gratitude. This is how she ends it. Perhaps if this society as a whole spent some part of its time in a state of simple gratitude for the beneficence bestowed upon it, and perhaps if we individuals were daily to remind ourselves that this beneficence is a gift, not a mere entitlement, we might at last assume the posture necessary for finding our way out of all the treacherous byways of this new territory that she has been describing, and back to where our nature truly beckons us and lead our bewildered children behind us. So here again, the practice of criticism has led this virtuoso of the genre to offer thanks for the gifts that are not to be mistaken for entitlements. These two memoirs, in two very different voices, both end on the same note. Thus, I want to emphasize that gratitude is not only what we feel for Norman and Midge, it is also the intellectual framework for our being here this evening. And it prompts the question, how is it that two of our sharpest critical minds, sharpest among Americans and sharpest among contemporary Jews, how is it that they arrive so decisively at this same destination? What is their relation? What's the relation of their criticism to gratitude? So Norman Podhoretz, born in 1930 into a Jewish immigrant family, used his biography as a springboard for social history. And he does it so well that I think that we ought to have organized a reading rather than a talk about him. It all began with language, he writes. And this is Norman. I was born in this country, in the Brownsville section of Brooklyn, but as a very small child, I spoke, or so family tradition has it, more Yiddish than English. My father, Julius Podhoretz, had been here for 18 years, and my mother, Helen, née Henya, well, for 10 when I came along in 1930, and they both knew English reasonably well. But my paternal grandmother, Runya, lived with us when I was little, and she barely spoke English at all, despite the fact that she too had been here for quite a long while. And he proceeds to introduce his family through the ways they mastered Yiddish and mangled English. It's understandable that the child who became a terrific writer should have paid close attention to language. But it's equally plausible that the rich interplay of language in his childhood made him want to control the medium. Some of his most incisive observations about acculturation have to do with acquiring English. And the saga begins when he is 5 years old, at school, and cannot find his classroom. A teacher asks, "Where are you going, little boy?" "I'm going up the stairs." He does it much better. "I am reputed to have replied." At this, the teacher instantly marched me off to the principal's office and had me placed in a remedial speech class. Now, there are as many stories of this kind as there are immigrant children in public schools. And most of the stories hang on the humiliation that they had to endure. Irving Howe, for example, liked to tell the story of the kindergarten class that he was in on the use of cutlery, where the teacher held up the implements and asked the children what each was called, and when she held up the fork, he called out, "Goppel!" And that's Yiddish for fork. People used to know, but okay, prompting a lot of laughter. So Norman does not pretend to have enjoyed the many steps of corrective education that rid him of his Brooklyn accent and turned him into, quote, a facsimile wasp. Teachers intervened aggressively, much more aggressively than could be imagined today. But he knows that without it, he could not have won a scholarship to Columbia University or to Oxford University on graduation. The teachers wanted him to become a full-fledged American, quote, not only in the social, but also in the cultural sense. And if you were starting from farther back, you had to overcome your handicap and accept that those who truly wanted your advancement would not condescend to let you stay where you were. Making it in America required becoming an American. Now, Midge treats her upbringing with even less sentimentality. She was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, as the third daughter to parents already middle class. Her mother was born in St. Paul. Her father fought as an American soldier in the First World War, and his clothing store supported them even during the Depression. She came of age during the Roosevelt administration that was, for most Americans, synonymous with synonymous with America. And she experienced the same shock that many of us felt on first meeting our first Republican Jews, or Jewish Republicans, in her case, in the form of the Florida branch of the family. When she tells of growing up, she doesn't spare any sympathy for the person that she once was. Quote, she writes, "The critic and my one-time boss and dear friend, Robert Warshaw, once said that an adolescent boy is someone who wakes up one morning to discover that one of his arms is longer than the other and that he has a permanent erection." Well then, Hey, guys. Well, then, an adolescent girl is someone who can live through all the upheaval of her country's having gone to war, her friends, neighbors, and relatives going off to the army or navy, the bustle of everyone at home's playing some part, even if only a laughable one in the war effort, the shortage of things like meat and butter and gasoline that had been everyday features of life, and most critically for me and my friends as the years wore on, of cigarettes, the early bad news from the fronts of both Asia and Europe. Someone who lives in full consciousness in the midst of all this and at the same time sincerely worries that her ears are too big or her thighs too fat. So this may sound as if the adult woman does not take her adolescence seriously, but the opposite is true. She never loses sight of those who stay in the self-absorption of adolescence. Like Norman, she seems always to have experienced herself as part of her society and uses her own evolution to frame a study of what was going on around her. When Norman and Midge found one another, they had certain things in common. Both had attended the Jewish Theological Seminary, though not at the same time, and though both worked on higher degrees, neither got a doctorate. Now, this is a theme I often strike, I hope not too often. Truly independent thinkers balk at having to apprentice themselves for too long to academic routine, and their love of freedom shows in their thinking, their prose, and their nerve. So both Norman and Midge worked at Commentary at different times and specialized in the kinds of essays that were published in that magazine. Though, of course, they also wrote for other publications, and in Midge's case, they also edited other publications. As far as I know, the only thing they actually co-authored were two of the four children they raised together. Yet, as intellectuals, they were drawn to many of the same subjects out of similar concerns, and they both were ready to do battle when they saw that it was necessary. So, to show a little bit of how they advanced our thinking specifically, I chose two essays on the same subject, Relations Between Black-Skinned and White-Skinned People in America. I read Norman Podhoretz's essay, My Negro Problem and Ours, when it appeared in Commentary in 1963. I was 27 years old, and it was the most provocative essay I, or my older brother and father and Len, had ever read. Norman called it auto case history after the case history method that journalism and social science used to eliminate a general issue, except that he uses his own experience in presenting his argument, which is very risky when you are challenging accepted opinion. The journalist citing case history will present material from a certain slant, but here the writer offers himself as proof of his contentions. Trust me, and you are likelier to trust my conclusions. But dislike the claims, and you are likelier to distrust and to dislike me. And boy, was this argument unpopular. First, it turned upside down the accepted liberal idea of victimized blacks and proprietary whites. As a boy growing up in Brooklyn, Norman was at a disadvantage against black predators in the only battleground that mattered, the playground and the streets. He offers vivid accounts of being pursued and dangerously threatened, not by white Christians, which is the standard story that Jews tell about anti-Semitism, but by Negroes, the supposed objects of white aggression. From that, he goes on to say that the same mutual dislike and distrust of his childhood continued in gentrified form. He writes, "Thus, wherever we look today in the North, we find liberals with no previous personal experience of Negroes, people to whom Negroes have always been faceless in virtue rather than faceless in vice, discovering that their abstract commitment to the cause of Negro rights will not stand the test of direct confrontation." This was written on the eve of the passage of the civil rights legislation that was expected to solve racism. And here was Norman saying that the expectations were simply not realistic. He explains the cognitive dissonance of liberals who don't want to admit that the evidence that he is providing, and who lack his willingness to face what they know to be true. He calls out the intellectuals who romanticize Black Americans and pander to them, assuming a guilt that is not properly theirs. Those are his words. Where we lived in Montreal, the only black-skinned people I had come to know in college were smart and handsome West Indians. So I was shocked by the admission that there was real hatred between the races, not just as James Baldwin described black hatred of whites, but as Norman Podhoretz now confirmed, of white hatred for blacks. I thought, did he really have to dig so deep into himself to admit those feelings? Wouldn't it have been enough to lay out the problems? Hatred was not an emotion I had ever associated with intelligence. But the essay pushes itself even harder when it nears its conclusion. This was not a confession, much less an apology. It was rather a dose of reality from an adult now obliged to confront his and his society's negative feelings to suggest how one could get beyond them. Given the truth as he sees it, he concludes that the only answer is intermarriage, miscegenation between the races. I am not claiming, he writes, that this alternative can be pursued programmatically or that it is immediately feasible as a solution. What I am saying is that, in my opinion, the Negro problem can be solved in this country in no other way. And given that this was an auto case study, Norman then tested the viability of his proposal by asking himself whether he personally would want his daughter to marry a Negro. He concludes that no, he wouldn't like it, but hopes that he would have the courage to give her his blessing. And he writes, "How dare I withhold it at the behest of the child I once was, and against the man I now have a duty to be? The answer to hatred is not love, but readiness to accept its consequence in the next generation." So you can see, I think, why this essay, which I've only sketched and I don't intend to engage, drew hundreds of responses, and why it remains such an important document in the intellectual life of the author and of the country. The feature I want to highlight here is its moral confidence. I often use this term because I think that an open society finds it much easier to stand up to military attack than to moral reproach. The Great Depression undermined American confidence in capitalism, helped along by communist interference long before the advent of the internet. The Vietnam War undermined America's belief in righteousness, in its own righteousness. The push for civil rights legislation highlighted the evil after effects of slavery. Liberal guilt began to take over national pride. And Jews were especially prone to this kind of self-doubt, encouraged by a culture of self-accountability and reinforced by centuries of having been negatively perceived. Jews had participated actively in securing equal rights, in upholding civil liberties, in fighting discrimination. But as soon as liberals were attacked for not having solved the problems, Jews began to apologize and appease their new antagonists. So along comes this Jewish intellectual who makes no apology for Jewish wealth, holds nothing back in his distrust of those who aggress against him, makes no excuses for his assailants, and allows no one else to make excuses either. This essay assumes that Jews and liberals have a legitimate right and even a responsibility, especially a responsibility, to stand up for their interests. When in the history of the diaspora had a Jew felt so free to diagnose his relation to aggression on the assumption that his experience could serve the entire country? Heinrich Heine did it through bitter satire. Others, like Marx and Freud, presumed to transcend Jewishness in supposedly universal categories of social science. Norman does it in straightforward American style. I have told the story of my own twisted feelings about Negroes here and of how they conflict with the moral convictions I have since developed in order to assert that such feelings must be acknowledged as honestly as possible so that they can be controlled and ultimately disregarded in favor of the convictions. So feeling must yield to convictions, and one's own soul is not the worst place to begin working a huge social transformation. So this Otto case history turns out to be, for me at least, above all, a study in intellectual daring. The essay was a literary breakthrough for Norman, who then wrote his book, Making It, in the same personal analytical form. We should keep in mind that 1963 was still an interval in American history when race was a subject for relatively frank give and take. There were debates on the subject between Podhoretz and James Baldwin, between Irving Howe and Ralph Ellison, and with Norman Mailer, who felt that whites should appropriate black style energy. The situation was just about to improve legislatively and socially, but it was to worsen culturally and politically. So positioned as they were at the center of New York intelligentsia, Norman and Midge observed political and cultural shifts with seismographic precision, and there are few better ways of tracking the history of those decades than reading their essays. In September of 1977, Midge published the essay, Looting and Liberal Racism, a shocking insight into how quickly one set of problems had morphed into much deadlier ones. This, she begins, on July 13, 1977, in the evening, New York City went suddenly totally dark. The electric power had failed throughout the entire city. Within minutes, several neighborhoods in the boroughs of Manhattan, the Bronx, and Brooklyn were aswarm with gangs of young men and little boys, lead pipes and gasoline in hand, on a rampage of looting and arson. Later, no doubt when the mayhem had become widespread and irresistible, a certain number of women and girls joined in. Small stores, restaurants, and supermarkets were broken into, their stocks cleaned out, and fixtures smashed. In one neighborhood, the Bushwick section of Brooklyn, the fire department was literally unable to keep pace with the night-long and then day-long setting of new fires. So this opening describes the energetic, massive departure from law-abiding citizenship of whole sections of the city. The occasion for the rampage, note, was not a real or perceived miscarriage of justice, but the opportunity of a blackout where criminality felt that it would not be punished. Following her detailed and unsparing description of events, Midge Dector gives the standard explanations, really excuses, that liberal New York offered for the violence. She singles out a truly disgraceful op-ed in the New York Times by a Jewish professor of labor history that compared the looters and arsonists to the group of Jewish housewives in 1902 who organized a protest against the high cost of kosher meat by throwing meat into the street to rot. Midge writes, anyone who actually watched the looters at work, as those of us who lived in looted neighborhoods were privileged to do firsthand, and as millions of Americans did briefly on television, knows that they were doing no such thing as those Jewish housewives. They were having the time of their lives. These were not acts of rage, but acts of opportunity by people who did not feel bound by the same rules that applied to the rest of the citizenry. Now, some black mothers were trying to raise their children with strong values, she points out, rightly, but liberals were undermining their attempt. Here is part of this summary. Young blacks are getting the message from the liberal culture more subtly, but just as surely as from any old-time Southern sheriff, that they are inherently and by virtue of their race inferior. There are virtually no crimes they can commit that someone with great influence does not rush to excuse on the grounds that we had no right to expect anything else. Moreover, there is virtually no traditional form of manliness, fathering one's children, defending one's women, that is not considered a cruel and bigoted demand to make on them, given the difficulties it would bring them. They must not be judged by the standards that apply to everyone else. The message they are given, in short, is that they are not fully enough human to be held morally responsible for their own behavior. The real battle being waged then was between liberal racism on the one hand, the racism of no expectations, of condescension masquerading as empathy, and on the other, insistence on basic law and order. Dechter does not minimize the after effects of slavery and institutionalized discrimination, but she knows that liberal condescension is much more debilitating in the long run. She writes, however hurtful and humiliating it must have been for a grown black man to suffer being called boy, surely nothing can suck the marrow from the bones faster or more thoroughly than calling a bad boy blameless. So we can imagine how different America would be if that sentence were engraved over the doorposts of Chicago. So the neoconservatism, as it came to be known, of Norman Podhoretz and Midge Dechter arose not as a political program, but in the same way that these two articles and hundreds as good as these responded to the clear and present dangers at home and abroad. Their responses and ideas often overlapped with those of Irving Kristol, whom we spoke of last time, but with one difference, and that difference being the terminology of war and warfare that began to appear in their writings. Norman's books carry names like The Bloody Crossroads and World War IV. Thomas Jeffers calls the last section of his marvelous biography of Norman Podhoretz, New Wars for a New Century. The subtitle of Midge's memoir is My 7 Decades in Love and War. This vocabulary was very odd, given that the American cultural elites were retreating from any desire for military engagement. Protests against the war in Vietnam did not end with the war, but morphed into protests against any use of military power on the part of America. And in some sectors, against the idea of war, even as a last resort. Hence, Norman wrote, Why We Were in Vietnam, to provide the indispensable intellectual defense of American intervention and the case for American strength in defending political freedom. He writes, for at least the last 5 years of American involvement in Vietnam, this is what he writes about the years 1970 to 1975, hardly any voices had been raised in defense of our continued participation in the war. The arguments all came from the other side, and for the most part, they remained unanswered. Knowing that the ultimate defeat was defeat in the war of ideas, Norman took up the challenge and laid out arguments for why we went in, why we stayed in, and why we withdrew. And in a final section entitled, Whose Immorality, he concluded that the anti-war movement bore some responsibility for the horrors that overtook the people of Vietnam. There was an all-important distinction between lesser evils and the ultimate evil of totalitarianism. And those who failed to make that distinction enabled the victory of the most murderous regimes. Norman is masterly in confronting self-deceivers who adopt a posture of intellectual neutrality, and his arguments can, of course, be applied to many subsequent battles of the same order. The terminology of battle did double duty. in this debate. First, it rehabilitated the readiness for warfare as one of the requisites of democratic survival. And secondly, in taking the war of ideas to the enemy, neutrality between America and its enemies was a form of anti-Americanism that had to be fought on the domestic as well as on foreign fronts. And he was the person to do it. Now, the war of ideas was fought mostly in print, today in cyberprint, but Midge did something more than that. And here I hope I may be allowed to draw on personal experience. I've belonged to very few organizations in my life because I'm not a joiner, but one was indispensable to me, and that was the Committee for the Free World that Midge founded in 1981 in defiance of those who sneered at the term free world. She founded it by issuing, and here I'm quoting her, a strong statement of support of both political and economic freedom, and in opposition to all forces everywhere working against those freedoms, and invited primarily intellectuals, authors, academics, and scientists to sign this. If they signed, they were members. If they objected to this or that, there would be no room for them. Since we regarded ourselves as being at war, and words were to be our only weapons, we had no intention of watering down our purpose by making ourselves a large tent. So, for freedom and against those who were against freedom. I signed on the minute I was given the chance, and I attended every conference. I wanted to be among people who wanted to bring down the Soviet Union. The Committee for the Free World published a small monthly review called Contentions. And one day, I saw that Saul Bellow's name had been dropped from where it was previously on the masthead. When I asked about it, I was told that he had objected that a review critical of his friend Gore Vidal, written, I believe, by Midge Dechter, had been published in Contentions without his consent. I was appalled that he would put his friendship with Vidal or with anyone ahead of the committee's work. As it happened, this coincided with Saul Bellow's coming to Montreal for the dedication of a library in his name. I was one of the speakers there, and naturally I spoke in highest praise of him, but I couldn't let the matter go. So I slipped him a letter saying how disappointed I was that he left the committee over a pettier, much less worthy consideration. Just as Midge said, the committee could not be watered down because one of its members had a friend in another camp. Bellow was notoriously prickly when it came to any slight to his writing, but in this case, rather than take offense at my note, he suggested that we should go out to dinner the following evening. I really can't swear to it, but I think he knew it was right to put the committee ahead of any personal pique or point of pride, although, unfortunately, I don't think he ever apologized to Midge. So this incident, I think, reminds us of how much strength of character it took for this couple, unlike Bellow in this respect, to break friendships or allow friendship to be broken over the cause of freedom. The sacrifice of personal comfort is the hardest part of any conflict, military or otherwise, and the consequences to them, for them of their political clashes were, I think it is fair to say, monetary, honorary, and certainly social. Norman and Midge fought for the best in Western culture and to uphold the ideal of excellence against apologists for communism and against those who would not oppose it, for the rights of women, and against feminists who lied about the nature of women. One could single out, in its power and prominence, their fight in defense of Israel and against its enemies, mortal, diplomatic, and intellectual. But most of all, they took up the cudgels for America, demonstrating how and why the country prospers and why it deserves to prosper. I happened to be in Russia in the summer of 1981, when the Soviet Union collapsed and I raised a glass with those I was with to Ronald Reagan and to the Committee for the Free World, the two parties in America that fought hardest to bring it down, in my view. Intellectual warfare differs from the military kind in that its weapons may have lasting importance, making it Norman's first highly unpopular intellectual memoir is by now recognized as an American classic. Norman's two follow-up intellectual autobiographies are primers on how to do intellectual battle, Breaking Ranks and Ex-Friends, Falling Out with Allen Ginsberg, Lionel and Diana Trilling, Lillian Hellman, Hannah Arendt, and Norman Mailer, will soon be accorded the status of American classics too, if they aren't already. Other forms of recognition were also forthcoming. Norman was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, Midge, the Truman Reagan Medal of Freedom. Their place in American culture is going to be inseparable from the fate of America. So I think that now maybe we understand a little better the place of gratitude in their writing. Democratic culture requires that citizens spend about half their lives, only half if they're lucky, being governed by those they voted against, having to accept changes in governance that they opposed, paying more than they feel they rightfully owe, experiencing real danger and maybe fear over decisions they know will backfire. It takes only a slight turn of the political screw to get from opposing a policy to opposing the political system that allowed that policy to be introduced, from being against a president to being against the country that elected that president. The strain of anti-Americanism that entered the country's political bloodstream in the 1960s kept intensifying and spreading. The many virtues of self-criticism turned into the vices of grievance and blame. Living at the center of this contagion, Norman and Midge heroically exposed its dangers and tried to stop its spread. That also required preserving the good and praising, celebrating what the free world has achieved. Gratitude for all of that. So to conclude, I could sign off with "the rest is commentary." But that would call for much fuller praise of what Irving Kristol called the most influential Jewish magazine in history, and President Ronald Reagan called one of the most influential journals of thought and opinion in the world. And you will have noticed, perhaps, that I barely touched on the feature of the Podhoretz-Dechter legacy that many of us honor and appreciate the most. At another festive evening in 1995, celebrating Norman on his retirement after 35 years as commentary's editor-in-chief, where the speakers also included Henry Kissinger, I was also given the privilege of praising Norman. I said that in the course of defending freedom and democracy, Norman became Tzofe Levet Israel, the watchman of the House of Israel. American Jewish intellectuals have been divided between those who lived out in the world at the expense of Jewish concerns and those who were preoccupied with Jewish problems, but who spoke mostly to their own constituency. Norman merged the two as a proud and free Jew, born and bred in the USA. If you read his essays on Israel from the 1970s to the present, I think that you would agree with me that his leadership of the Jews, the most thankless of his achievements in the short run, may in the long run prove to be his greatest. And that was said before he addressed and answered the world's eternal question, why are the Jews liberal, in his book by that name. So there is much more to be said. Thankfully, there is all of that to be read. So let me end with our version of the riddle of how something sweet emerged from the strong. Strange as it seems, this warrior couple, our most skilled intellectual combatants, are the ones who led us to blessing. Most of all, what they want me to do and they want us to do is to give thanks to the country and to all that it is for us. But I think that in all that, we do it through giving thanks to them and all that they stand for. Thanks so much. By then, I had been reading Himmelfarb for more than a decade, and I hadn't thought about the difference between an intellectual who looks for information to support his ideas and a scholar who wants to know everything that there is to know about a subject.